Just about 28 minutes after the hour on this Thursday morning, and Pastor Robbie is right on time. And Robbie, we were wondering, because I know last week we were talking, and there's a baby due, and that's tomorrow.
You've got a
full plate here.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Yeah, we're going to try to get things going tomorrow and see if that baby comes this weekend. So okay. Looking forward to it.
You already know, you know the sex, don't you?
Jacob Sylvester Pruitt. Yeah, okay. Named after my mom, Sylvia. My grandfather, Sylvester, was his middle name. Mm-hmm. So Jacob was his biblical name. We'll call him Jacob.
That's a good one. Hmm. That's a good one. Yeah. Well, we'll be praying for you, Dan, that it all goes smoothly and that God's in the middle of it, and he usually is, and I'm sure he will be there for you, along with Jacob and our best Irene, too. Give her a big hug. Well, maybe just pat her on the shoulder, you know. And
that's right. Say, this she already knocked the coffee out of my hand with that big belly.
Yeah. Got to be careful there. So.
Yeah, it's a dangerous morning already. So
Robbie's an Anglican pastor, lives in Ashburn, Virginia, where his church is in Fairfax, Virginia. And he's also the executive director of Preserving Bible Times. Their website, of course, preservingbibletimes.org. You can link to them from ours at brokenroadradio.com if you're of a mind to do that, and we heartily recommend that. We've been wending our way through Luke for weeks, and we've reached Luke 20, and we thought we reached it last week, but we dipped back a little bit to 19, and then we got to the beginning. There's so much more in Luke 20 that I have questions about, Robbie. Where do we start?
It's hard to move forward, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
When it's so good, you kind of hang out there a little bit. Well, Luke 20 is just chock full of context, is all the Bible is. I mean, we pretty much ended with looking at the authority of Jesus being challenged by the religious leaders, Pharisees.
That brings up a thought. You have to know to look for context, though, don't you? It's so easy to read and just pretend you're reading a novel or a modern-day book. I mean, it's or a time piece, you know, a historical piece. But unless you're looking for context, you tend to miss it.
Right. One scholar, I think it was G.K. Chesterton, said that the Bible never yields its meaning to lazy people.
How true that is. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. So we have to be willing to do our work. You know, I mean, it's not going to interpret itself. It's not going to unpack itself. We have to read commentary. We really just need to begin with doing what we've been doing here, which is reading the passages before and after our text to see the text within its context.
But there's certain questions you want to ask, like, what is happening? Who's present? What might be the motivations for being there? And then see how they interact. And that goes right down to linguistic issues and translations and focusing on and specific words, like in Luke where Jesus heals the hand of the right hand of the man in the synagogue. Why does he bother telling us it's his right hand? Well, there's a whole purpose behind that those people would have related to instantly as they heard that story, which was an historical event, not a parable. So you got to be sensitive and be alert for context.
The left hand was for unclean business, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And the right hand was reserved for eating and things like that. So when it's pointed out it's the left hand, I mean, again, we're dealing with a Western context of our own. We kind of look at the Bible, as Kenneth Bailey says, the Bible's an Eastern book. We see it through colored glasses of the Western culture. Much is lost. So we don't have hand sanitizer in the first century. We don't have this, so it illuminates that kind of text.
Well, and if you remember how they ate, lying on their left shoulder side on a triclinium table, the right hand was used for eating. If the right hand was disformed or injured, you couldn't eat, and you couldn't eat with other people especially. So this man was isolated. By having his right hand withered. So there's aspects like that you need to be alert to. And so what when you're reading, is there a contextual resource that you would recommend people have right at their hand as they're reading the Bible? One or two books of a particular value?
A study Bible is a good place to start. A study Bible with maps in the back. Like I use the New King James, the Nelson's New King James study Bible. The cultural Bible I use, the cultural study Bible as well, and just reading the text before and after a text. I mean, Bible Gateway has free commentary on their site under study tools. you don't even have to pay for it. You can actually read your text there, read it in multiple translations, which I highly recommend. Begin with a literal translation like the ESV, go over to a paraphrase and read the passage again in multiple translations. Define terms you don't know. Look up and Google things like Pharisees, scribes, Sadducees that we'll talk about a little bit today in that Luke 20 resurrection passage. So just looking into the text, questioning the text, again, not questioning the validity of the text, you certainly can, but just asking questions of the text will help the bottom
and
drop out.
One thing that might trigger the idea that there's a contextual issue here is if you run across something that doesn't seem to make sense or actually seems to pose a contradiction. How could he say Absolutely. This when he just said this? Probably it's a matter of context.
Right. As Gary M. Burge said, all literature is born within a cultural context or a cultural landscape. It will pick up themes and images from within that cultural landscape and use them generously and build a framework from which stories can be told. This is no less true of the Bible. The land and its culture, not merely the history that happened there, are an indispensable aspect of the biblical story.
Well, Luke 20, I didn't mean to the diversion, but context is so important. I want to focus on that.
It is. It's important that folks know what we're doing when we're beginning to look at a passage, and so that they can have the tools to do this themselves. That's what we're all about at Preserving Bible Times.
Well, last week we talked about the gathering. This was when Jesus was teaching in the temple courts, and he brought up John the Baptist and challenged the Pharisees in a number of ways, and he did it in front of people. They were there to entrap him, and he was brilliant again and evaded the trap and turned things around, turned the tables around on the Pharisees. Where do we go from here?
Well, follow it down. I mean, we began to talk about the parable of the wicked tenants and Jesus basically outlining that these religious leaders were going to be like the wicked tenants in the vineyard. They were going to take him outside the city walls and crucify him there. And so he basically foreshadows everything and he quotes Isaiah, the stone that the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone. Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken into pieces. And when it falls on anyone, it will crush him. So he's telling them this parable. Verse 17 says he looked directly at them when he says this. So he's speaking against the religious leaders, the scribes, the Pharisees. Later, we're going to see the Sadducees, because he's showing the tensions that are building that they're about to crucify the Messiah.
Well, keeping in mind that this was Passion Week. This is probably a Monday or a Tuesday where he was teaching in the temple of that week. He's got crucifixion a couple of days ahead. They know it, and they're trying to set him up for that, to justify their actions to the public. He's not letting it happen.
And Jesus is controlling the timeline. He wants to be on the cross by Passover. And so he's moving towards that even now, even provoking folks who were trying to basically trap him, which is why the very next account we have is the paying taxes to Caesar. The scribes and the chief priest, again, here's how you question the text. Do I know who a scribe is? Do I know who a chief priest is? They sought to lay hands on Jesus that very hour, for they perceived that he had told the parable of the wicked tenants, against them, but they feared the people. Again, he did tell this parable against them. They knew it. They perceived it. And so here we have the text giving us insight into what just happened.
It was almost daring them to arrest him at that point.
Yeah, so as they watched him and sent spies to pretend to be sincere that they might catch him into something to deliver him up to the authority and the jurisdiction of the government. So they asked him, "Teacher, we know that you speak and teach rightly and show no partiality, but truly teach the way of God. Is it lawful for us to give tribute to Caesar or not?" So here is a politically charged question, and we just came through an election day this week.
Speaking of politics, they were surrounded by Roman soldiers.
Back then, politics got pretty nasty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's gotten much mellower since then.
It's
calmed down quite a bit since.
Indeed, we say tongue in cheek. Yeah, so they're questioning him, trying to trap him. whether or not it's lawful to give tribute to Caesar. But he perceived their craftiness. And I love when the text tells us, you know, gives us the insight into Jesus's perceptions even here. And then Jesus says, show me a denarius. Whose likeness or inscription does it have on it? And they said, Caesar's. And he said, render to Caesar that which is Caesar's, and to God that which is God's. Now, Jews are not supposed to be possessing anything with a graven image on it. And this coin has an image of Caesar. Mm-hmm. So Jesus turns their trap into his trap.
That is subtle. That's something you would miss if you didn't know that.
Right. Right. So again, you know, one of the things you know whether or not you're dealing with a Jewish burial, like if you look at a bone box, an ossuary, if it has any kind of graven image on it, you know it's not Jewish, because the commandment is thou shalt not make any graven images of anything. So a Jew is not supposed to be possessing something with a graven image upon it. And here it is, he's asking to show them a denarius, and whose inscription does it have? And they say Caesar's.
Yeah, and he said specifically, what about the denarius? He didn't say, he said, show me a denarius.
Right.
And foolishly, and one of them pulled one out, yeah.
Right, so they're asking him, are you compromising your commitment to Rome? And he's asking them, in effect, are you compromising your commitment to the one true God for Rome?
Is there any context or anything to be understood by knowing that this is an old coin? I mean, it's a coin that's at least 50 years old.
Wow. Well, in the time of Christ, but yeah, it's more the type of coin it is and whose image it has on it. And you can Google the coin, you can look at the image and see. And
coinage is important, because when a conqueror came in, it was one of the first things he did to advertise his control was to make the money, to print the coins, mm-hmm. to put his chosen artwork on the coins. That was true back with the Hasmoneans when they took over. They finally got the chance to make their own money, and they chose a palm frond, which became a nationalist symbol for Israel, because it was on the coins. Here, there's a picture of Caesar. It's a reminder of who's in charge.
It's advertising, it's marketing, it's propaganda, it's communication. It's basically the billboard of its time, the coin. Mm-hmm. And so Jesus is taking the religious leaders' trap, and he sets a trap for them as well. And then he says to them plainly, then render to Caesar that which is Caesar's, and render unto God that which is God's. And they were not able, and this is key here, they are not able, verse 26, in the presence of the people to catch him in what he said. But they marveled at his answer and became silent. He shut them up, which is brilliant. I mean, Jesus is one of the most brilliant, he is the most brilliant communicator that ever did live, one of the most brilliant teachers. And here we see him exercising his wit, his wisdom, his knowledge, and his skill in communicating clearly to the religious leaders and controlling the narrative and the timeline.
And doing it under intense pressure.
Indeed. Well. And now, if the scribes and the Pharisees and the religious leaders weren't enough, the Sadducees come in, and the Sadducees have their own particular bent, their own particular issue, in that they do not believe in the resurrection. And here's an ingenious verse. And again, the Bible will tell you what you need to know, but you have to pay attention to see what it's telling you. In other words, there came to him, verse 27, some Sadducees, those who deny that there is a resurrection. There you have a group of people, the Sadducees, and a definition, what you need to know about them before you continue reading, all in that short verse, verse 27.
You wonder if the Sadducees had the crucifixion in mind, if they'd had rumors, because he talked about coming back in 3 days. That had to be floating around the air there. It had to have added to the level of anticipation. How is that possible? No way. You know.
Well, again, and he assaults their idol of the temple. you destroy this temple, in 3 days I'll rise it up, build it again. And they said, you know, this temple's been under construction for 46 years, mm-hmm. and you're going to reconstruct it after tearing it down in 3 days? And basically John tells us that the meaning of this, because in John's gospel it says, but he was referring to his own body. But he didn't spell that out for them because he wanted them to be offended that he would tear their temple down, because it points out that they had made an idol out of the temple. Mm-hmm. They worshiped the temple complex, the gold on the walls, but not the God of the temple.
And reacting in wonder that he would presume to rebuild the temple in 3 days had to be their way of counteracting the rumors that he would be resurrected. I'm convinced that those had were floating around Jerusalem, because Jesus, on what we call Palm Sunday, when he arrived, was a subject of great attention and excitement and near revolution. And they must have had inklings of what was about to come, because, one, Jesus had taught his disciples what was going to happen, even though they didn't understand the impact of that, the fullness of the issue. I'm wondering what the scuttlebutt was around Jerusalem during this time.
Well, you've got a mixed crowd here. I mean, we know that not all the religious leaders held what the Sadducees believed or didn't believe. The Sadducees here in verse 27, we know they deny there's a resurrection. We know that even Herod Antipas himself believed in the resurrection when he assumed that Jesus was John the Baptist resurrected. Mm-hmm. After he had him killed. So we can see that people do believe in the resurrection, but here the Sadducees do not. They deny it, which again could mean, again, add to the burn of what Jesus was saying about the temple. They were not picking up on that he's referring to his body at all, because they don't believe in the resurrection. So they were taking him very literally when he said, destroy this temple and I will build it back in 3 days. They're not considering he's speaking about his body. They're thinking that he really means insurrection here.
Mm-hmm. Now, he goes on and talks about marriage.
Yeah.
How do you link that into this, this discussion?
Wow. Here? Well, I think we could be here for an hour talking about it, but you link it from Genesis chapter 2, and you go all the way through Genesis chapter 2 through John 14, and you land on Revelation 21. I'm going to explain to you a little bit about what I mean by that. The Bible begins and ends with a marriage. It begins with Adam and Eve's marriage in the Garden of Eden in Genesis chapter 2. And so if you know that, and you know that it's not good for man to be alone, and I apologize, I missed one stop. We got to stop over. In John chapter 2, the Feast of the Wedding at Cana in Galilee as well, want to get there. But if you look at Genesis 2, that God takes the rib of man and he makes a woman, and he brought her to the man because it wasn't good that man would be alone. And Adam says, this is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman. And because God is never alone and we're created in God's image, it's never good for man to be alone. So God creates a helpmate, woman, and so we have the first marriage. Therefore, man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife. They shall become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed. This is a picture of the Godhead, a marriage, where you have such intimacy that it produces life. And a oneness that the two shall be one is very similar to the triune God, that the three shall be one. And God's love cannot contain itself in such a way that he creates humanity. Well, here, our love in a married relationship cannot contain itself, so it produces life. I'm about to experience that life yet again here soon, this weekend, with the birth of our fourth child. So if you look at Jesus' words, do not let your hearts be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And if I go to prepare a place for you, I will come again and take you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. John 14, 1-3. This is wedding imagery, because when a man takes a wife, he brings her to his father's house. But before that wedding can take place, he has to build a room onto his father's house so he has a place for his bride.
Yeah, the old insular homes, which were usually one generation after the other, living within the same set of walls.
That's right.
If a man had four or five sons, there'd be four or five rooms, four or five marriages arranged, and marriages were arranged by the father of the groom.
Well, let's trace it. Let's go on to Revelation 21. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, John said, verses 1 through 3. And the first had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw a holy city, a new Jerusalem, coming out of heaven, listen to the words, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. Mm-hmm. I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will be with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be their God. Now let's look at the Sadducees. They ask him a question. Teacher, Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies, they're quoting, by the way, Deuteronomy 25. They're saying, if a man's brother dies and he hasn't given his wife a male heir, then the brother has to take the brother's wife as his own and give her a male heir. Well, the Sadducees seek to trap Jesus and say, okay, this woman has had seven husbands and no male heir. When she dies and gets to heaven, when she receives resurrection, whose wife is this woman going to be? That's a good question. Many of us in our culture, our Western culture, have this question. Say your spouse died and you remarry. When you get to heaven, who is your spouse going to be? Maybe you've been divorced and remarried a couple of times. Whose spouse will you be? It's a great question, but the Sadducees ask it to trap Jesus. And Jesus said to them, the sons of this age marry and are given in marriage, but those who are considered worthy to attain to that age in the resurrection of the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage. So Jesus is giving us a taste of eternity, what resurrection life looks like, and he's telling us there won't be marriage there. So this is like Luke chapter 16 in the parable, the issue of rich man and Lazarus, where we get some insights in what heaven looks like. Luke gives us more insight with Jesus's words. So let's ask the question, whose wife will this woman be? And we know from the entire text of the scripture, from Genesis to Revelation, that this woman's husband will be Jesus. Because she is the bride of Christ. The church is the bride of Christ. And if the church is the bride of Christ and there will be no more marriage in heaven, why won't there be? Because we are his bride and he is our husband.
The Sadducees were offering a false choice to Jesus. If they didn't believe in resurrection, that is no life after death, why would they even ask the question about after death, whose wife will she be?
I mean, because they think it's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But really what they're drawing upon is a living, breathing metaphor of Christ and his church, which is marriage. It is the theology of the community of God. We celebrate this in the Anglican Church on Trinity Sunday, that God has never been alone, that God has always existed, Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit from the foundation of the world, and is in a divine love relationship with himself. And if it's not good for God to be alone, when God creates Adam, it's not good for him to be alone either, because God is not alone. So God makes a helpmate. And the family, the nuclear family, is born. And out of that love produces love. And so the divine commandment is be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. Why? Because that's what God does. God multiplies. God grows. God creates out of his love. There's an outpouring of God's love in his creation of all things. So again, the consummation of all things is God dwelling again with his people. So in the sin, the brokenness of the garden, we get new life birthed into the new creation.
And they couldn't respond.
Yeah,
it
shuts the mouth of the Sadducees.
Brilliance again. Just amazing. these confrontations, and knowing this was in Passion Week, he's about to face a crucifixion. I mean, I'm trying to put myself in his shoes, or actually any of the pilgrims who would come for Passover to Jerusalem had to be caught up in this whole story. Expectations, high tensions, near revolution on what we call Sunday, they would call first day, and that accelerated all the way up until the event itself. Just an astounding story here in Luke 20. And Robbie, we've learned some things that we'll look forward to. Hopefully next week you'll be available. I don't know. You may not have slept for
That's right.
days on end. So,
well, it's a pleasure to be with you all. I encourage you to go back now and read John 2. And when Jesus makes the water into wine, it's not new wine, it's old wine. Do you believe he saved the best for last?
Yes. And there's some great resources on that very topic at Preserving Bible Times, preservingbibletimes.org. If you want to go to the website, you'll discover things for free you can download and read, and even some videos that are free or gratis. But there's a lot of e-books and now streaming video. And even the e-books you can just download. You buy it, you download it, you got it. Instant gratification, as they say. That happens at Preserving Bible Times, too. PreservingBibleTimes.org is the website. Robbie, we thank you. We'll look forward to next week, and our best to Irene. Okay?
Pleasure, gentlemen. Thanks so much for having me on. Good to be with you, Jim and Dave.
Bye-bye. Good to see you, Robbie.